Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Well, hello, hello. My nostrils, listener, are being assailed by wonderful fragrances being released from the flora and foliage of Regent's Park. And it's a kind of a charming day to be out in the park, just warm enough to make things pleasant, and here to make things yet more pleasant, Mike Althorpe, urban historian.
And architectural explorer.
And
or something.
Or something, yes. You're one of those people with many, many titles.
Yes, I do a range of things, usually walking around, taking pictures and exploring London's history, architecture, and kind of tramping the streets, really, looking for new stuff and stories to tell, really. So.
Yeah, well, we're in the same line.
Yeah, that's great. Brilliant. Happy to be here.
We need to mention the well-known Mexican organisation with which you are connected. It always reminds me of Speedy Gonzales.
Arriba.
Arriba.
Arriba. Yes. One time, public programs manager at the RIBA, organising talks and events at the fabulous HQ building. RIBA being the World Institute of British Architects, and they have a fantastic gallery and talks and events programme down at Portland Place in the centre of London. Yeah, was part of that for many years. And now freelance tour guide and explorer, as I said, and doing research about all sorts of figures in London's architectural history.
And we're going to be focusing, I think, on one of those in particular.
We're going to be looking at John Nash today. John Nash is perhaps one of London's greatest architect planners, perhaps up there with Christopher Wren, really, in terms of the impact that he had on the city. He was the guy in the late 18th, early 19th century who was responsible for driving through the street we know today as Regent Street, which, of course, is in the heart of the West End and basically the main thoroughfare through the centre of town. He also was responsible for many palaces, houses, and where we are today, Regent's Park. He was the visionary designer, creator behind what we see today, which is a set of quite fantastical terraces, villas, streets and landscapes, which I'm calling scenes of wonder at the moment, just as a catchy walking title, really. But essentially, he was the guy who pulled it all together.
So I should, before we get underway with finding out about Nash, I should say that we've just emerged from Regent's Park tube station. Listener, I don't know if you've been there, but if you were street side, you might fail to notice it's there altogether. There's a couple of roundels, but even Google Maps doesn't like to give too much away about its existence. Close enough to Great Portland Street Tube for you to think that it's just another entrance to that, and very underused.
Yeah, I understand, strangely, one of the most underused tube stations in central London. So, yeah, an absolute delight at rush hour.
Which must be good for your tours.
Yes, it's a good place to meet, but it's actually obscured by one of Nash's creations, which is Park Crescent, which is where we're standing at the moment. We're just opposite on Euston Road. One half of Park Crescent has been demolished. It was a recreation, a 1940s recreation, but it kind of supports one of the themes in Nash's life, which is the idea of the importance of the facade and the setting. Many of Nash's contemporaries in the 18th century ridiculed him as being a collector of things rather than a serious architect. He didn't care about the detail. He was a scene setter. And really, it's to London's benefit that he took that approach. He built very grandly in what you see around us at the moment, which is stucco, this oil-painted, cream-washed buildings covered in plaster, which essentially mask what are quite cheap brick buildings. And he did this all the way around the park and also all the way down Regent Street. So he was an architect, but also an architect with a very a very strong sense, responsibility for budget. He was also a developer. He had an eye on money. He was a bit of an opportunist. He was a player. He, a real networker. I mean, today he would be all over Instagram and all of those things, basically hashtagging his career to pieces. But he was a really very keen networker and worked very closely with the Prince Regent, after which the street is named, and also the park. He became his great patron. And really, it was because of that association with the Prince Regent, George IV, that all of this happened. There was a few things, crucial things, that kicked off the development of the Regent's Park. It's kind of threefold. I mean, really, the state, essentially, wanted to get in on the act in the late 18th century on making money from speculation, housing speculation. And so the state was, as now, seeking ways in which to realise their assets. And one of those assets was this giant space north of the edge of Georgian London, which was called Marylebone Park. And that essentially is the Regent's Park that we're standing in. That was about 300 acres worth of land, which had returned to the state. And so after a long lease, they were able to explore opportunities for developing it. The first plan was basically for housing like you'd see in Bloomsbury or elsewhere in Marylebone, which is lots of streets, lots of squares, quite a dense arrangement. This was abandoned under fear that the state had seized the land for private profit rather than public enjoyment. Marylebone Park in the late 18th century was a place, it was fields and farms and dairy farms. And so, a lot of Londoners would head north and hang out in the fields. So the idea that the state was seizing those fields to speculate and make money created a lot of political tension at the time. And so the park itself came out of quite a set of strange circumstances, or happy accidents rather, and compromises. So the landscaping idea was put in after a lot of political pressure.
To give the... Well, we're back to facades then, aren't we? To give the impression of it being a lovely public space.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it was primarily a commercial development with park worked in between that. And that was really what John Nash achieved very successfully, about how to balance the needs of the state, or the desire of the state to make some money, to speculate, to have a commercial development, but also give Londoners this public space.
Now, the several things I can summon to mind about that period all seem to suggest that that was a bit of a perfect storm then, because on the one hand, I think people were looking for investment opportunities around that sort of time, lots of bubbles and so forth. But another thing that was very fashionable was order, and imposing order on landscape. So in a way, this is a dream project.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. And there's, the terraces and villas are all about the idea of order, and classical orders in particular, or Palladian orders, this classic development of London terraces in five parts, which you see reworked time and time again around the park. You have your giant central feature, usually some sort of pediment. At either end, you have another smaller set of pediments, sort of flanking wings, and then in between you have the terrace, usually with the runner columns. In the Regent's Park, Nash plays with that incredibly. So you have Ionic, Doric, Oriental. As I said earlier, he was a collector of things. He didn't care for the what was appropriate. He was a real commercial sort of architect.
Now, does that mean he was architecturally illiterate?
No. He knew what he was doing. He was just very canny, and he played with that. And very successfully so. A lot of the terraces here are, slightly crude in detail, but the overall effect, as we'll see as we wander around, is pretty spectacular. The bright cream stuccos standing out against these really beautiful mature trees and landscaping.
Well, let's dodge then into the park, and it's pretty well fenced off on all sides. It sounds pretty obvious from what you're saying that Nash was good at networking and getting in with the right people. What were his roots?
Well, he started practice in about 1775. I mean, he was a commercial architect working on a series of small villas for lots of private clients outside of London.
So he must have come from a fairly well-to-do sort of background.
He was landed gentry commercial family who were merchant class, not particularly high up in society, but middling, doing quite well.
I guess I was wondering where he would have got the vantage point to have that sort of vision.
Well, again, I think it was developed over his career. He worked with somebody called John Repton on his houses out in the countryside, and John Repton was a landscape architect, and he did parks, and working with a lot of people who wanted a country seat, Nash provided the villa, and his colleague created the landscape around it. That was a very 18th century desirable product. People wanted to live like that, to mimic the landed gentry elsewhere, or the aristocracy. And so it's through that work that he was eventually was working in the Office of Woods and Forests, which is essentially the government's development arm, the State Land Management Company. Not sure exactly how he managed to get into that role, but you can assume he was a keen talker, and this role presented itself. Quite interestingly, it wasn't his colleague John that got that role, it was him. So, yeah, he's kind of worked his way through a lot of clients at that time, and eventually landing himself in a government role, advising lots of people on the development of London. Well, I suppose it's a very good timing, really, for him, because it was at that time where people were talking about the problems of London. The West End had grown exponentially. It absolutely, you know, exploded in terms of its density and people and streets. And there was a desire to improve communication north and south. And this is where the idea of Regent Street came from. It wasn't necessarily John Nash's original idea. He made it what it became. He decided the final route, but the origin of the idea was much earlier. He happened to be in the role as it came to maturity.
So let me get that clear in my mind. Was he connecting up to areas that had sort of naturally formed that were busy, or was it a question of sort of pushing the boundaries further north?
Well, it was a bit of both. I mean, the West End had developed westwards, basically, and had reached Hyde Park, and there was no major north-south street beyond Tottenham Court Road, which is the road going to Hampstead, essentially. The main roads were all heading west, and that was out into Oxfordshire or out into the West Country. The main highways were in that direction. And so the traffic chaos that had...
Was Oxford Street called Oxford Street because it went to Oxford?
It wasn't, actually. Oxford Street is named after the Earl of Oxford, who was the landowner immediately to north. Oxford Street used to be called Tyburn Road, after the river, which runs nearby. But there wasn't a north-south route, and so people wanted to reform the bits of the West End. There were landowners who didn't want to go cheek to jowl with Soho, because that had fallen into Bohemia, which is a lot more interesting, but the aristocracy were no longer living in Soho. The nature of those estates had changed, and so there was a desire to drive a street through and to connect up this piece of land, this opportunity north. And for the commercial success of this, for this place to really work, you needed access. There needed to be a clear route. And that was, you know, how you linked up the scheme. It was really John Nash who started really taking control of that idea and linking up all the spaces in between. One of the key visions that Nash sold, particularly to George IV, the Prince Regent, was the idea of this processional way, this royal route, which would connect up the one-time palace down at the bottom of what is now Waterloo Place, which was Carlton House. So he had this idea that St James's Park and the Royal Palace down there would be connected to another royal structure up in the centre of Regent's Park. So the heart of Nash's plan was this building called a Guinguetta, which is essentially French for a kind of fun palace. If you go to parks in, you know, Germans call it beer gardens, French call it Guinguetta, and essentially it's a beer garden. He was proposing something slightly different, but it was a summer residence. The idea that the Prince Regent would, in his carriage, head north along Regent Street, up into the park, and he would have a base amongst this beautiful new landscape with all these terraces of well-to-do housing. And it really was that idea. This was to be an exclusive suburb. And that's another interesting thing about that whole idea. The park, the landscaping was an accident, but in bringing these things together, we have the birth of, you know, the modern idea of the garden suburb, which we're still talking about. We talk about it in different terms today as the garden city, like Wellen and others in the early 1900s. But this was the kind of the origin of that sort of idea that you could mix housing and development. You could be close to the city, but you could have this outlook, which is rural, pastoral, and, you know, this idea of Arcadia, mixing landscapes, views, scenes of wonder, which is the name of the talk, and, you know, the lake, the movement of people with this fantastic landscape of buildings framing, you know, backdrop to people's activities and the life of the spaces.
How interesting. So I wonder, and maybe this goes further forward than we should really, but with the rise in fashion of romanticism and that sort of wild, non-urban taste, I wonder whether this started to look a bit fusty after a few years.
Well, it took a very long time to build, but I think it was still very desirable as a place. It didn't stay desirable for too long. I mean, it took a very long time to build, really.
How long did it take?
Well, the whole scheme was over 20, 25 years. We started planting the trees in about 1813, and it wasn't until the early 1830s that essentially, just before Nash had died, the government said, right, stop work. We can't keep on developing it. Nash spent the whole of the latter part of the 1820s desperately trying to reinvent, come up with new ideas for making this scheme more commercially viable. The terraces closest to the city, which were towards the south and the southwest, worked very well. They were let really quickly, but the ones further to the north, they really struggled to sell, to make viable. So this is quite a modern story, really, about commercial viability.
Just given how we started the broadcast talking about the quietness, relatively speaking, of Regent's Park Tube and the difficulty of selling these places at the top of the park, I can't help noticing for the middle of the day, in the middle of this city, we are on our own here in the park. There are very, very few people. I can see fewer than 10.
I've realised as well, I've taken you on a route that can see very little architecture.
Well, I was going to ask you, I mean, we're essentially in the middle of fields. I can't avoid the innuendo, but where is your fun palace?
wherever I find it. we'll head east slightly here to the Broadwalk. So the fun palace was, the Guinguetta, was halfway up the Broadwalk, which is the broad avenue in the centre of the park, which actually sits on the same axis as Regent Street. So if you look at it on satellite or maps, you can actually see that there's a kind of logic, this processional route, this idea again of the Prince Regent and this ceremonial route would connect up the whole development all the way from Waterloo Place down at St James's Park through Piccadilly Circus, up round the curve of the quadrant, over Oxford Circus, through Portland Place, over Park Crescent where we started, which is the kind of gateway to the park, and then straight through the centre, and it would have landed at this royal summer retreat. As it is, the avenue carries on north, hits London Zoo and kind of fizzles out. And this is the point where people usually ask, how do I get to Primrose Hill?
And through the penguins.
Exactly. And so you have to do an awkward left. So this processional route doesn't really end in anything particularly glorious.
Well, it's notable as well, isn't it, that he didn't retreat very far. Well, I mean, he could have retreated to the Yorkshire Dales or something.
No, but that's true. I mean, this was
not even as far as London Zoo.
The Prince Regent's big retreat was in Brighton at the Royal Pavilion, which John Nash also worked on, which is happening at the same time. And this is this is where the kind of politics and the messy business of patronage and his closeness to the prince. He was essentially being given all the major works, and this created quite a scandal. And if you look at periodicals from the time, John Nash is lambasted. There's this great cartoon of him standing on the spire, or spiked by the spire of All Souls Church, which he designed opposite the BBC on Portland Place. And it's called National Taste, and it's meant to be a crude demonstrator that this is a man who is out to make money and to rob the public of much needed funds. I mean, while Regent's Park was being built, the Royal Pavilion was being refurbished. George IV was also rebuilding Buckingham Palace. And so the idea that he needed another palace was ludicrous, and it was quite a scandal. A lot of people were very angry about this idea that the Prince Regent could have, more and more places for enjoyment.
It's particularly remarkable when you consider what had happened to the monarchy 100 years before.
Well, this is it. I mean, one of the really interesting things about the park is this fear of the mob. The French Revolution was only a few years before, 20 years before the idea had come up. So this idea of, keeping public calm, you know, avoiding scandal was quite, you know, foremost in a lot of politicians' minds. And it was really the political pressure from other people that you know, changed the plans and the nature of the park that we're walking around now, and in particularly the Summer Palace not happening. But of course, Prince Regent was quite pivotal as well, because he championed it very publicly. He'd make grand addresses about London outdoing Paris, its great rival. So it was the idea that through the Prince Regent and John Nash and the creation of the street and the park and all the embellishments in between, that London would be reframed in glory, finally, to outdo bloody Paris.
Well, that idea really lives on, doesn't it? I think it does. Particularly in how the banks are treated in this country. You know, we need to have a strong, thriving financial sector that, unfortunately, taxpayers have to bail out every so often at great cost. But it'll be the envy of the world.
Absolutely. It's our glory that banks are doing so well. We should all be... We're very proud of that fact.
But I'm delighted. How about you?
Yeah, no, I wake up every day and thank everyone that they're doing so well. But, you know, as you say, the rivalry between London and Paris is ongoing. But at that point, it was quite pronounced. I mean, in many ways, actually, London ended up taking the lead, an early lead on creating these streets through the city, you know, breaking through slums and narrow twisting. Essentially, you know, some medieval, some early 18th century lanes and muses. I mean, it was something, obviously, that Paris later in the 19th century made its own through Baron Haussmann and all of the streets you see there. But in the 1820s, it was London that was leading the way, really, in terms of creating modern streets for a very modern sort of way of life. Regent Street was designed as a shopping street, a place to promenade, a place to be seen, and really that idea extended into the park. You know, lots of people would come up with their carriages, and there were soft amusements around the edge. You had on the far right-hand side, or I should say east, shouldn't I? You had the Colosseum and the panoramas, which were essentially illuminated paintings and tapestries, and people would essentially, you know, come and prom and hang out here in the early 18th century. Nash didn't originally want that to happen. He felt that the mixing of recreation and vulgar amusements would drive the price down.
Now, you haven't really mentioned the vulgar amusement. Should I have been reading vulgar amusement in between the lines?
Colosseum. I don't know if it was particularly vulgar.
When you say Colosseum, I mean, you don't mean people fighting lions.
No. Literally, it's... I mean, it's... The building is still there. Perhaps we can go and have a quick look at it a bit later. But we're talking about a rotunda, a building with a big panoramic views in history, which were illuminated. So you had...
Why is that vulgar?
It's a bit tacky. Nash thought it was tacky.
I wouldn't mind one in my garden.
Oh, big painting of Vesuvius?
Yeah, why not?
Yeah, okay. Well, yeah, why not?
I see, our tastes differ.
Nash was a bit of a hypocrite, because actually he was in the same business. His entire output was about creating scenography, you know, creating settings and views and pictures. He was doing it in 4D. So, he was a bit of a hypocrite, kind of picking on the guys who create amusements in-house for the whole of Regent's Park. Is 1,000 postcards, one of which is coming up now-ish, I think. No, I'm a bit early. Anyway, but... The building we're coming up to on the right is Cumberland Terrace, and this really is
I should locate that. That is...
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
As we're walking up northwards up through the park, that is far to our right, through several tiers of trees.
Yeah. But basically, this is the grandest, most bombastic, fantastical terrace of all of them. And, you know, they're pretty big. And this one, the centre of it, is lying on the axis of where the aforementioned summer palace would have been. So we're kind of near that spot now. And eventually, when those amazing mature trees break, you'll get this view, which essentially is I think there's about 56 columns worth of facade there, and this giant classical arrangement over 8 bays, which also sneakily includes a couple of semi-detached houses just behind a column of screens. But at the heart of it is this giant pediment, which at the top of is a statue of Britannia. So it's this idea of the palace, which was so crucial to a lot of these terraces, that actually these are individual houses standing together but give the illusion of one giant country seat or giant fantastical palace.
Well, that is quite impressive, as you've described. Trees are just lining up. I noticed, by the way, that the trees are more or less on a grid system as well.
I mean, the boardwalk that we're walking down, these trees were all planted originally in 1816. And so, yeah, this was all... This is the only, I suppose, geometric element of the scheme. Nash believed greatly in the idea of the picturesque. Going back to the idea of romanticism that you mentioned, I mean, that's what the park and English landscaping was trying to do, conjure up this idea of a naturalistic place, you know, that it, you know, man hadn't touched this. It had just, you know, been found, this kind of idyll, this Arcadia.
Nope, I'm not getting that. Not only are the trees equidistant and lining the sides of the walkway here, but as they go back in 5 or 6 rows, well, they're on a grid system. There's no other way to put it. They're all in straight lines. How is that natural?
Okay. Away from the boardwalk. It's a lot more...
Oh, it's more natural over there,
is it? Okay. Sorry. This is the only geometric element. But yeah, this elsewhere, the naturalistic...
Apart from the non-naturalistic stuff, it's extraordinarily naturalistic.
Yeah, well, yeah. But at the same time, you know, John Nash... This is how prolific he was. He was also re-landscaping St. James's Park, you know, as a demonstrator of the shift of style, of taste, and you know, the idea of the fear of the mob, the fear of Europe, or the difference of Europe. In the 1600s, Charles II had André Le Nôtre come over to London and landscape St. James's Park with this giant 1,000-foot-long canal, this sharp, you know, ruler-edged piece of water in a very European Renaissance enlightened way. John Nash kind of tore that up in the early part of the 19th century and transformed that into a much more meandering piece of water. Again, it's this idea that it was a natural landscape and that was an English way of doing things. But of course, the geometry, the proportionality, the kind of classical on the edge was there to reference this kind of Arcadian landscape, sometimes ancient Greece, sometimes Rome. But in the case of Cumberland Terrace over there, this was a row of houses as national monument almost. That pediment that you see with Britannia is telling what was the start of a big imperial story for Britain in the 19th century. And so with the, I suppose, lack of money to create the public monuments or the public edifices and buildings, he snuck it onto a commercial development. So it's really, you know, doing two things. It's working very hard. It's telling a national story. It's setting the view on that edge off very nicely. But it's also providing housing for the upper middle classes. And these ones were very successful.
Do we know who all the statues are?
We don't, but they're mainly deities, which kind of covers everything, really. Nymphs, deities, caryatids. I mean, some of them are allegorical. Britannia is there. She's there with a shield and trident. But elsewhere, they're Venuses. They're, you know, this Greek mythology, these figures of beauty and of progress, of peace and of tranquility abound in this space.
It's very difficult to follow on from that line, I've just realised. I feel so overwhelmed. I'll have a quick snooze.
Yeah. good place for it, I think. Yeah.
Well, we're coming up for one of the world's most ornate, if you rule out Victoria Park, one of the world's most ornate drinking fountains.
Yeah, this was, I'm going to forget the name of it, it's dedicated. This wasn't part of Nash's thing. This came much later in the 1860s, when the life of the park shifted quite considerably.
Yeah, it's got that same Victorian municipal thing going on, hasn't it?
Oh, yeah. It's a monument to somebody called Parsi, I think. We can see the name and get closer to it. I think he helped the British out in India in a tricky spot, as they often were.
Yes. And so I just wanted to jump, because it seems to me... tell me if I'm wrong here. I could be completely wrong. But that seems like an inversion of the principles that we were talking about just a moment ago with Cumberland House, which is that over there, they've got a commercial thing, and strapped onto the front of it is something that looks a bit public. Here we've got something that is a public monument, but it's functional. It dishes out water. And that seems to me kind of representative, from what I can tell, of the Victorian ethos, that it's about serving the masses in some way a lot of the time, getting the infrastructure in place.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think that's a really crucial point, really. I mean, although the spaces around and in front of the villas, the Regent's Park was public, it wasn't public as we knew it, as we know it today. I mean, really, that idea of the public park was a Victorian invention. We had commons and so on, but around the edge of Regent's Park were a series of gatehouses and tiny little villas, which essentially is where the security were. And as you notice, we come in, there's some gates. They don't close anymore, but at various times the roads and access into the park would have been heavily restricted. I mean, park's still closed today, but you know, they're essentially beagles keeping an eye on who was coming into the area.
So this was like what people have said about the Garden Bridge proposals, in that they're gives the semblance of being public space, but is in fact not so much.
Yeah, it's quite similar. I mean, it was public by virtue of the ground landlord being the state, but, you know, this wasn't a place for riffraff in the 1820s or 30s. But later, as the nature of this area shifted, the nature of the people using the park... Should we go this way?
Well, I don't know. Are they riffraff down there? They will be by the time we're down.
By the 1860s, the areas to the east of the park had become very industrial. The Euston Railway had arrived in the 1830s, and Camden had really grown up as a very working suburb of a much larger piece of London, of inner London. And so really, the facades create this... this quite firm barrier between two worlds, which they still kind of do today. And this idea that we started with, the idea of the facade, is so important. You know, you're controlling the space, and I suppose the mood, the air. You know, architecture does that all the time. Setting is very important. Creating intrigue or creating ambiences and responding to the landscape is something that he did.
It's worth saying as part of that that it smells awfully nice here, and that was one of the first things that struck me as we got close to the park, was the fragrance of blossom and flower. And I guess in the 1830s that couldn't have been more important.
Yeah, I've never really thought about that, to be honest.
Well, we just had the arrival of the railways, I guess. Some of those places around the back of King's Cross, which were less desirable, they'd have gone. Yeah. But you'd have had the smoke coming in from the railways to take the place of the stench of the rubbish heaps.
Oh, yeah. I mean, much as then as now. I mean, you know, London's parks are its lungs. And, you know, to get away from the smog, the industry, as you say, to have these spaces and to make them genuinely public was crucial. It's really important. It's something that, interestingly, in Paris, they borrowed the idea of the large parks and the open fields and spaces for all sorts of activity from London. I think it was Napoleon III who was here on exile. He went back to Paris and gave Parisians the Bois de Boulogne, modelled on the parks that he saw in London, because Paris didn't have those spaces. So London is, you know, blessed with these incredible chunks of green, which, yeah, in the Victorian city must have felt even more of a, you know, a refuge from life outside. But again, going back to this idea of facade, there is a very keen divide between the life of the park, the facades, and what you see at the reverse, which I suppose is the carrying on the theatrical illusion of scene setting. This is backstage. This is where the dirty business of the development was happening. As part of the development of the park, Nash also developed a series of marketplaces, places where trades and fruit and veg sellers, hay markets, all sorts, would actually facilitate the park. It was also a place where the materials to build Regent Street and all the houses came in. So we extended the Regent's Canal down on a spur, almost to Euston Road. So down behind these fantastic terraces lies this grubby, workaday bit of city, which was central to the success of getting this stuff off the ground. I mean, at that time, canals were the way to bring materials into the city, and Nash understood that. He was a very, you know, in terms of programming development, he did that fantastically. You know, he knew what he needed to make that work, to get the materials, you know, a logistics sort of guy as well. So this is why he's so fascinating, really, that he was covering all bases.
Well, we've passed between... Actually, what we're passing between is two sets of children's play apparatus, and I suppose that carries through the idea that you're talking about there with the grandness being up the front end and the... Well, I don't think children are dirty business, but they're not quite as glamorous, and they've been confined to this rear part of the park.
Well, I think Nash would have put them in togas or something a little bit more appropriate to the classical illusion. I'm not sure. But he would have designed
little
that
wings
tower.
And bows and arrows.
That would have been a Tower of the Winds, not this pirate adventure. I mean, again, the sort of thing going on in the park, Nash had to relax, really, because, as I said earlier, it wasn't the biggest commercial success. And so the commissioners, who were in charge of the budget, essentially, they'd have to accept that there'd be greater diversity of uses in order for it to make it pay.
Riff-raff.
Riff-raff. You have the zoo arriving in the 1840s, a bit later, actually, after Nash's death.
Well, what would Nash have made of that?
Well, originally it was set up as a scientific institution, so I think he would have been all right with that. But as a place of amusement later, yeah, he may have had some trouble.
Giraffes in togas.
Exactly. Well, it's interesting. One of the architects he was working with, a guy called Decimus Burton, which is one of those great early 19th century names, meaning 10, my 10th child, which is great, Decimus. He actually designed the first buildings in there. So this guy went from designing, working with Nash on these classical, you know, terraces, to building giraffe houses and aviaries, which is quite interesting. I mean, essentially they're warehouses, but some of them are still there, which is great. We're coming up to a church, the name of which escapes me momentarily.
But the clash of architectural styles is impressive.
This is what makes the story of Regent's Park so much more interesting.
I should describe very quickly. We've got one of those big cream-washed terraces that we've been talking about. It must be in width, I would guess, around about 15 miles. And next to it, there's a small church, all higgledy-piggledy, dark stone, Tudor chimneys, and a thin spire poking up.
Yes, so this was something that was constructed in the 1820s as a church, and it was a college. But essentially, Nash hated this. He was really affronted by the idea that this architectural harmony was going to be destroyed by incorporating what is, as you say, a Gothic rough brick building with spires and gables and visible chimneys, and, you know, it didn't fit his vision.
God, getting in the way again.
Yeah, absolutely. But, you know, you compare it to the thing on the left with its Greek deities standing on the top of the pediments. This is a controlled vision. This is an aesthetic battle here, but Nash had to accept that he wasn't going to always get his own way on it. Again, this is, you know, the interesting thing about it. It's a lot of it is a compromise. This kind of happy accident. History, tends to tell us, you know, the glorious continuity of things. But what's a lot more interesting is the kind of skullduggery, the nepotism, the all of the arguments and fights and compromises that people had to make to have these outcomes. And London's built fabric is a symptom of all those sort of things, which is kind of, you know, even more fascinating.
What's your view of Nash by the time he gets towards the end of his life? What sort of person do you think he was?
I think he was just pretty frustrated, but he needn't have been. I mean,
well, really, yeah, after all of this achievement.
Because of the scandal, I mean, his patron, George IV, were basically told to calm down, and his budgets were cut, and so Nash lost his patron and lost his sponsor, lost his client for so much work. So I think he was frustrated. I mean, the fact that he kept on producing these plans and revisions for how he was going to squeeze more delight into this park or more commercial development, I think demonstrates that he desperately cared and wanted to keep going. It was the commissioners that just said, that's it, you know, no more, it's finished, just let it be, essentially. But Nash wanted to keep going. But when he died in 1835, this was maturing, this was taking off. So it was, a great success. I'm not sure commercially it was the most viable thing. It's a strange thing that, it started life as a way for the state to make money, but then the state snookered itself by creating a public space from which it couldn't make money. Was going to find it very difficult to make money.
There's definitely a flaw in that plan.
No, absolutely. I mean,
it's a delightful flaw from which we've all benefited.
Absolutely. We're doing it now. But there was a plan originally for about 28 villas to be distributed through the park, which, never happened. There was only about 8 built, and they were very difficult to get off the ground, and some of them were demolished. But, Nash was trying very hard to add things, to reimagine it. At the very heart of the park, where we walked through earlier, there was this plan for a giant double circus of buildings, which would be, a park crescent in double, but even bigger. And, he was still working on that in the late 1820s, when it had already been demonstrated that a lot of the traditional terraces were quite difficult to let. Park Crescent itself, which was one of the first schemes that started in 1816, was abandoned because they couldn't get the financial backing. I mean, it's quite an ominous start to such a grand project.
I feel like there's two different things you're saying there. One of them being that they couldn't let them once they were completed, and one that they couldn't get backing. And both of those seem extraordinary.
Well, when it started, this was this was a completely new venture. It was something that was going to be set in amongst countryside or the illusion of countryside, parkland, and actually this was at the extreme north of built-up London, and so the fashionable developments down at Mayfair, this was where the prime property was, the estates, the Grosvenor estate down in Mayfair towards Hyde Park. London was expanding in that direction, and so this was the peripheral. So that in that sense it was risky, it was the edge of town, it was a new venture, and it took, I suppose, quite a bit of effort to convince people to invest and to make this place their home, and for builders to take the risk. Nash himself took the risk on quite a lot of projects. He financed them. He was a developer and an architect, and so that says a lot about his conviction, his determination to make this project work. He threw his own money at stuff and became a developer, and created his own project through his own money. So I think that's very interesting. But there was boom years for the park. As I said earlier, the terraces that we passed towards the south, they were let very quickly. But towards the end of the development, I suppose, fashion had changed. The drift of London was shifting. Belgravia was taking off. And so a lot of the most fashionable developments had headed south by the 1830s. And so over the course of the 19th century, the nature of this area changed very dramatically. As I said earlier, you have London Zoo arriving, you have all these different amusements, you have the railway either side of the park, and by the turn of the 20th century, a lot of these terraces were semi derelict. There's great shots in Reber's archives, actually, that show the terraces just before the Second World War, and they're rotting. The oil paint facades, the plaster is hanging off bricks, and they've been subdivided. So there's been a curious kind of shift in how people view these. I mean, the late Victorians called Nash's buildings sham architecture. They didn't value them at all. And so they didn't think anything of tearing them down, which down at Cambridge Gate, which is on the east side, which is what they did. They rebuilt a terrace in this grand French style, this French Empire style, big mansard roofs in Bath stone, because plaster was considered sham. And actually that's kind of true, but but why not? It had the general effect, and again that comes back down to the idea of Nash as a scene maker, and not caring too much for the details, the overall setting. And so I kind of, it's a really interesting story for that. And I think, actually, the fact that these terraces are so desirable today and that people are spending vast amounts of money restoring them, you know, there's a constant smell of oil paint in Regent's Park because people have to keep an eye on this stuff. It doesn't last very long. It's only skin deep. It's brick behind. There's all sorts of cavity walls. There's bits that can, you know, damp can get behind all these different materials. And they're constantly layering on paint, oil paint, on top of these details, which they... There's a kind of cycle to these buildings. They layer it up, layer it up, layer it up. The detail disappears, and then they have to start again.
We've come to the end of our time. Unbelievably, that's whistled by. We might have to go to the zoo. In fact, I know what I'm going to do is I'm going to jump on eBay immediately and try and bag myself an enormous painting of Vesuvius for my garden.
Fantastic. It's, panorama.
If people wish to accompany you around a tour of the park or indeed somewhere else in London, how can they go about that?
Well, they could go to my website, which is novemberspawned.co.uk.
What?
I'm going to change it at some point. At the moment, that's the website. It's a Morrissey song. But anyway, it's a long story. But at the moment, that's where I kind of post my walks and tours. So the first one coming up with Reba is on the 11th of June, which I think you can book for now. Well, I hope so. So yeah, architecture.com is probably an easier place to find me. But if you check novemberspawn.co.uk, there's other stuff.
Or William, it was really nothing.com.
Exactly. Yeah. Suede head, etc. But yeah.
Mike Althorpe, thanks very much.
Thank you.
And that's all for this week. My thanks for this week to Mike Althorpe. Thanks too to Lizzie Cooper and Bernie Barkley. Theme and incidental music was by Songs from the Howling Sea. I'm N. Quentin Wolfe.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.